Thank God for Bitcoin podcast is brought to you by IRS GuardDog. IRS GuardDog is a tax monitoring service that alerts you to existing and even prospective problems that arise with your IRS account. I spoke with Clinton Donnelly, the CEO of IRS GuardDog, the other day, and he shared about a recent client that they had helped who hadn't paid his taxes in 6 years. I'm sure none of our TGFB listeners could ever fathom getting in that kind of situation, but he was, and he needed help getting up to date. So they took a look at his account, and through their service, were able to see that the IRS was preparing to audit him. He brought all his paperwork to Clinton and his team, filed 6 years of tax returns within a couple months, and checked his account a short while later to find that the IRS had actually reversed the decision to audit him, which saved him and his business thousands of dollars in legal fees and a ton of time. IRS GuardDog offers four service tiers, ranging from as little as $12 a month up to $249 a month for full active monitoring, consultation, fix, audit defense, and audit appeal. Clinton is a former pastor and was also one of our presenting sponsors at the Thank God for Bitcoin conference in Miami this past year. Go ahead over to irsguarddog.com and use promo code TGFB. You can find out more there and let them know that you found them via us. That does a lot to help support us as a business and ensure that we can continue to make podcasts like this going forward in the future. BJ Dichter, welcome to the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Good to see you, brother, and God bless.
Yeah, hey man, it's great to see you again. It's been, probably about 6 months since we were together. We keep missing each other. We've missed you in El Salvador. I think I heard that you were just there last month. Is that true?
Yeah, I spoke at the Adopting Bitcoin conference. I didn't realize that you had just been there.
Yeah. I came down the last day of Adopting Bitcoin and then was there for about a week. We were doing for TGFB. So, but yeah, I saw you posted on Twitter and stuff. I was like, oh man, I just missed him. But
well, don't feel so bad, because when I landed in El Salvador, I was extremely sick.
Oh no.
So yeah, I basically landed with a flu that was turning into a fever.
Oh no.
And that's, I got some medicine from the farmacia.
Yep.
And passed out for, I don't know, 18, 19 hours.
Oh my gosh.
Of Dayquil or their equivalent, and took a couple of coffees and as much adrenaline as possible, got through my speech, went for a quick pupusas, and then went back to pass out for another night.
Oh no.
Yeah, I only really had a day and a half in El Salvador to go to El Salvador.
Oh no, what? Okay.
Spent some time in San Salvador.
Okay. So now wait a second. I know you just spoke a little bit of Spanish. So you're not fluent, are you? You don't speak.
Depende tu español, mi. Yo hago muchos errores gramáticos, sí, claro, pero me encanta español y quiero practicar más. Y cuando yo tengo mucho tiempo para allá, después de más o menos 2-3 semanas, yo puedo hablar mejor.
Man, okay, so I was not expecting that. So, I mean, for everyone who is listening to this, that was very, very passable Spanish. So we'll give you a go. We'll give you a silver bordering on gold star.
It's funny when I go in the truck and I go to the States.
Yeah.
And inevitably, I'll end up at a warehouse at the loading dock.
Yeah.
And they'll start talking in like slang about the gringo.
El gringo.
El gringo estúpido. Like, oye, ¿entiendes el lengua? ¿Qué onda? You know, like this.
That's so funny. Oh my goodness. Well, so we need to get into your story here, because my interest in having you on here is I seriously tell people all the time when talking about the Canadian trucker protest that I had literally been praying for something like that to happen. Now, of course, I'm sorry, you can, you know, put the fault on me. I didn't want all the lives to be. I didn't want all the lives to be inconvenienced, but like, honestly, I've been thinking about something like this happening and being like a test case for Bitcoin for a very long time. And so I was just floored when I heard about it. So we're going to get into the trucker protest. That's probably why, I mean, I would guess the overwhelming majority of people who you meet outside of, you know, your native motherland know you is from that. But I would love to start just by getting kind of who you are and what you do now, and then, you know, we'll get into your background as well.
Yeah, so who am I? I don't know. I'm just a regular guy from Canada. I've been kind of a serial entrepreneur. I've lived a bunch of places, obviously South America. That's why I speak Spanish. And in 2014, I decided that, you know what? We all complain about the things that are happening. And I saw the cultural change at my business. I had a business on what was called then Ryerson University, which is in downtown Toronto. They've had to change their name because apparently it's now racist. In 2012 and 2013, we could see a shift that it's almost like, you know, the postmodern poison started infecting the student body and the faculty. And it just went parabolic, like something like they all took a drug and then all of a sudden they're common. And it was funny when I was in England a couple months ago now, and I was on Lotus Eaters, Carl Benjamin's or Sargon Kaw's YouTube channel.
Yeah.
He was one of the YouTube channels that I would put in my store to try to help inoculate some of the students against that stuff.
Yeah.
So I really lived this, and it just got out of control to the point that students would come in, they would demand that we would do work for them for free, and they want to print all this communist propaganda or this free Palpatine crap propaganda that's the guys, the terrorists and stuff like that. Because we had, you know, Muslim Student Association
sure.
on our campus, like all the others. And anti-Christian propaganda too, like all this really, you know, violent
great stuff.
And and I just, that environment was just so toxic. And then they ended up, you know, I don't tell this much, I've told this a couple of people privately, but the faculty, certain people in the faculty, I mean, I'll talk more about it now because you see what's happening, you know, Harvard is an example.
Yeah.
They, the certain faculty found out that I was Jewish. And started telling the faculty, their students, that you're not permitted to go to that business to have your portfolios done. And that's when I decided, okay, I'm out of here. Yeah, it was really crazy. And I would jokingly with it, because one of the students told me that, and I said to them, I'm adopted. I mean, I was. I'm pedagogically Christian. Does that help? I don't know. What are you gonna do? You can't make anybody happy, right?
Oh my gosh, man! So you're saying biology Christian, and then you were adopted by a Jewish family.
Yeah, the way it works, you're adopted before you're born, right?
Sure. But, okay.
About 10 years ago, no, 12 years ago, I think it was. I got a call from the police, and the cop shows up. He's looking for me. Okay, so he comes, showed up at my business, plainclothes officer. He's talking to one of my staff in the front door, comes to my office in the back and says, are you Benjamin? And I'm like, yeah. And he says, sit down. Okay. And he said, I always remember, he first said, I might as well tell you nobody's been hurt, injured, or killed. I'm like, okay, so I'm pretty positive. So that's the last thing that was on my mind. He's like, well, I've done a lot of that in my career. And then he says, do you know you were adopted? Because, oh, sorry, he says, I'm your brother. Do you know you were adopted? And he goes on to tell me the story of, you know, I joked with him a little bit, that we're not half brothers, we're full brothers.
Yeah.
And we have two full sisters from some very traditional families, some very wealthy, successful, and famous families in Canadian, you know, politics and military and stuff.
Wow.
Just didn't believe in childbearing before marriage. So we were all given away for adoption to different cultures.
No way. Oh my gosh. Wow. So you said that was 12 years ago that you got, that was.
I can't remember the exact year, 10 years, 12 years or
something. Wow.
Oh, God. And my brother, who is a cop, going into retirement, always wanted to have a trucking business. So he got a truck, COVID happened. He's like, hey, why don't you just come cross border with me? Because he convinced me to get my license. So come cross border with me, and at least we can get away from this stuff and spend some time together. And, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I got into trucking.
You forgot to clarify, you're horribly racist, brother, right? Because, I mean, all of you truckers are horrible racists. You know, you guys just hate everyone. It's but, okay, so let me just ask you. So what part of Canada were you living in at this point, and have you lived in?
I live in Toronto. Remember, Canadians don't move around like Americans do.
Okay.
Because if you grow up in Toronto, like, you're either going to go to, I don't know, Vancouver, Montreal, or what, you can go to Shaw. Like, you guys have cities all over the country. We're a lot more barren.
So you got you. Okay. From Toronto, I live here now. So Toronto. Okay. So you grow up, and, you know, right after graduating from effectively high school, what does BJ Dichter do? Like, what do you kind of get into?
I went to school, and I got a degree, certificate, however they describe it.
Sure.
In gemology, and I specialized in diamond grading.
No way.
And, yeah, so I worked as a diamond grader for, first as a diamond grader for, what, 3.5 years, and then I worked for a diamond conglomerate that was doing trade talks about the diamond mines and all that sort of stuff in Canada.
Huh. So, okay, so how long does that go on? How many years did you work in the diamond trade?
For 5 years, almost 5 years, and I invented a product for motorcycles. And I decided that, you know, it was, what, 24 at the time, 20, no, 25 at the time, something like that, after talking to a professor, a friend of mine's dad,
yeah,
was a business professor, and he convinced me that if you're ever going to try to do something, you know, entrepreneurial, do it while you're young, before you have a family.
Sure.
So I essentially quit my job once I had a little bit of momentum. I patented it. I patented in the U.S. I did the patent by myself, learned how to do a patent.
Wow.
I designed it, was working with a company that was setting up the manufacturing, and had it in, I think, 18 stores in the United States.
So what was the product?
It's fine for the type of bikes I ride are called crotch rockets.
Oh, yeah.
So it was designed for a crotch rocket. It was this form-fitting, basically a thick pad that was covered in leather with magnets and stuff like that. It was designed that if you go into the tank, there was actually almost like another seat in front of you.
Got you. Okay.
That would protect you, and also protected the tank from scratches from your zippers and stuff like that.
Oh, that's awesome. So did you have like any engineering background at all? Like, in engineering? No, no.
Well, I went back to school for a little while to take mechanical engineering.
Okay. Yeah.
If I liked it, because I've always been a hands-on guy. Like, I work on my own car. I rebuild in stuff like that. And but you know, that just wasn't. It was too slow pace for me.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, I'll just design a product and, you know, learn how to do a patent. I know how to read.
Oh my god,
I did it.
That's awesome. So I was gonna ask you. Oh no, I was gonna say no. Very few people know this, but I also have a motorbike. I have a Vespa. Now it's a GTS 3. It's a GTS 300. So I can do 80 on the highway. I can get up on the highway.
It's worth at least 2.5 horsepower. Isn't it?
Exactly. Yes, and maybe 3. Actually, well, we don't want to short shift it. But
I've ever ridden was on a track, and it was. I think I hit 296 kilometers an hour.
Stop it. Yeah.
75?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, man. I can't even fathom. There, actually, when I went to go get my, I have like a showy helmet or whatever. And so when I went to go get my helmet, I was asking the guy, I was like, do I really need to spend an extra $100 for the showy helmet? And he's going through and he's telling me, he's like, yeah, he's like, it saved my life twice. And so I just asked him, I was like, okay, you know, like, what happened? He's like, well, the first time I was going like 35 miles an hour, and, you know, I was, was like coming around and ended up just dropping the bike, laid it down, and, you know, was fine. And I was like, well, what about the other time? He goes, I was doing 180. And I was like, what on earth? He just hit some gravel and spun out and got thrown. And he's like, the cops showed up and couldn't believe that he was alive. Couldn't believe that it was him who was the guy who was in the accident, because he just said, you should not be here. Exactly. But okay, so you work in gemology for a while, then you build this product, you sell it in 18 stores, and where do we go from there?
I was living in Miami. We're gonna do an L visa, we're in the process of doing all of that and whatever. And my ex-girlfriend was still here. We had broken up. We'd been together for several years, but she was going to go back home, which was Mexico.
Okay.
And I was going to, you know, go on with my life in Miami and work on this business and expand it. And then one day she calls me up, and I always remember this. She tells me that, you know, I just went to the doctor, and she was 24 at the time, a few years younger than me. And she said, I just found out that I have cancer. And then she started just breaking down and bawling in tears. And, you know, certain people are very emotional, especially with those certain, just kind of like, I always remember that phone call for the rest of my life. And it's one of those times in your life where it's kind of like, you know, life is a test sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you have a path that's going to diverge in one of two places. And in my case, I thought I can do one of two things. Just leave her on her own. Because SARS was going on, you know, COVID-1 was going on and all sorts of regulations. And they're having problems with their visa and what it was a nightmare. So either I could leave her to her stuff, leave it with her, or I could just drop everything and just decide, you know what, this path has just ended and there will be other opportunities in the future. I had been meeting with, you know, potential angel investors, but we didn't sign anything yet. And I just decided, you know, I went into work the next day. I found somebody to take over my apartment because I had a great apartment, and I was driving back 2 days later on.
You were driving back to Canada with her.
No, wow. She was still living.
She was doing. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay.
I drove back to Canada to try to help her out, and she was in the hospital for 3 months.
Wow.
Surgery failed because she had stage 4, I think is what it was.
Oh,
pretty serious. But it was, you know, 6 months of a lot of noise. I talked about on my live stream that this is just the noise of life and the challenges and the things that teach you and make you stronger, and got through it. We stayed together for another few years, and ultimately, you know, things ended, wanted different things, and she lives in Mexico, has family, and everything worked out.
Wow. Man, so, okay, so she's back there. Now, you stayed in Canada, and so where do things go from there? Like, what's the...
I ended up, because of the product that I was working on, I ended up working for Harley Davidson.
Oh, no way.
Year. And then I ended up from there. I was working two things. I had a friend who had a business. So I was running one of their local retail stores, like being their general manager.
Sure.
And also working for Harley Davidson during the week.
Okay.
And
was it a similar industry? Was it like a motorcycle shop or just as a normal, some other kind of shop?
Computers and printing. It was in the computer industry. I've had a computer since I was 3 years old, right? So I'm quite...
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Okay.
And so I ended up... they offered me a gig being their sales director, their corporate sales director for all of Canada.
Okay.
And so I ended up leaving Harley-Davidson to work there full-time. And that evolved into me eventually opening up my own business, which was the university campus business.
Yep.
And then the next thing I know, I'm driving a truck and in the middle of this, you know, global story. I mean, I'll also say just one little caveat with that. While I was on campus, I was frustrated, as many of us were, and decided, you know what? Why don't I just take a kick of the can at politics a little bit? Just on the
Okay.
My local politician is a nightmare. CCP, full identity politics.
Yes.
Single progressive extremists in every part of the way. And my business was adjacent to the gay community. So it's a university campus and the gay community. What I learned is so many of them, they're fiscal conservatives.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but they are not allowed to openly be fiscal conservative. I'm like, what the hell is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the level of extremism.
Yeah.
Within their community, they said, well, why don't we just have some fun with your local counselor and make her look like the idiot that she is on public television, which is exactly what I did, and it was fun.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so you... Okay, so hold on. What year is this when you're working the business and then getting into politics?
2014, 15.
Okay, okay.
2014.
Okay, So is this like, is Jordan Peterson, I mean, I know he like kind of rose to prominence a few years later, but was he kind of making like offending all the same people at this point?
No.
Okay.
Jordan was a few years after that.
Got you. Okay. This is a similar thing. Like you're mentioning, what was the year? You said 2013, like when things really, 2013 is when you really started to kick up. Yeah.
Yeah. Postmodernism go full force. In the university.
Yeah. It's crazy you say this because I was just listening. So there's a pastor who's up in Moscow, Idaho. His name is Douglas Wilson. He's got people who love him to death, and he's got people who he drives him nuts. But he did, I can't remember, I think it was the University of Indiana. I think that's what it was. One of those in the Northwest, or like the central north of the United States. He did this, I can't remember which university it was, but it was this presentation called Sexual by Design that got into like sexuality and like, what is it and what are the consequences of it? And, you know, basically like unguided, like a biblical sexual ethic. And you can't, I mean, like it was right around that same time. And you can find it. If you look up Sexual by Design on YouTube, like it is nuts. The response that he got from people like interrupting him while he's talking. I mean, just like shouting him down the whole thing. I mean, now it's like commonplace, but I just remember watching that at the time and just being mystified. I'm like, how is it that these people are responding this way and like nobody has a problem with it? So you get back to this, you're running this business, you start getting into politics. And so you run against your local politician who, you know, is clueless. Do you win? Like what happened?
No. That was my first lesson in how, I don't want to use the word rigged, but how staged our politics is.
Okay.
And I saw the collusion between, in that case, local media and the political structures. And, you know, here in the municipal game, you're not allowed to be part of a political party. They all are. They all are part of the political party. So they're all breaking the law. They're all criminals. It's just that.
Now, when you say the municipal game, what is that? Can you unpack that? Because like they're
Toronto. So in Toronto, our federal system, we have municipal, provincial, and federal level of government.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. And so you're saying no. You're saying who can't be political? You were saying.
Oh, in my province, I think it's in my province. It's different in every province, but the people who run for like city council,
Are
legally allowed to be part of a political party, even though every single one of them is.
Yeah,
every single one of them is, and they all get funded through back channels and proxy organizations.
Gotcha.
Whatever. It's as corrupt as any banana republic.
Okay. Okay, so you go through that experience, you try to run, you get no traction because the whole thing is, you know, rigged to a degree. Where do you go from here? Did you end up trying again? Did you end up, like, what was people's response?
In this process, because this counselor was founded an organization, or co-founded an organization called Queers Against Israeli Apartheid. So Queers for Palestine, like, That's how out to lunch these people
are. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
What I did is I created, with some friends of mine who are gay, more on the conservative side, I created an organization called LGB Tory, which was designed to push back against that. That was the whole idea.
Okay.
To give people who are in that community, but they are more conservative.
Particularly conservative. Okay.
To allow them to kind of voice their opinion. And it was really interesting meeting some of them who described themselves as social conservative.
Yeah.
I'm like, hey, man, listen, whatever makes you happy, great. I'm libertarian. I want everybody to get along and respect each other even when we agree or disagree, right?
Sure. But once they're losing their meaning, it's not you can't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we ended up, and it's funny, now that I understand how tribal and structured our politics is, now I can see why. But what we did was we ended up having an amendment in the Conservative Party, tried to go libertarian on an issue, because all we would hear when I would say it was conservative, and everybody would say, oh, you hate gays. It's like,
Yeah.
No, we just don't care. We just want to move on. Yeah. No, you hate gay, but why? Because in the Conservative Party policy guide, they would point to this line that says, the conservatives define marriage between a man and a woman, therefore you hate gays.
Yeah.
So what did we do? Worked with some people in the party. We removed that line, and then to make everybody happy, so we tried, we inserted something for the social conservatives that didn't exist there before.
Uh-huh.
So what we did was we removed the definition of marriage, and then we put a line in the policy guide saying the Conservative Party supports the right of any religious institution to oppose same-sex marriage if it goes against the tenets of their faith.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to make everybody happy.
Uh-huh.
The libertarians are happy. The leftists can't say that they hate gays.
Yeah.
And the social conservatives know that we affirm their religious values, that they don't have to abide with by things that go against their faith.
Sure.
You think they make everybody happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nope. Can't happen.
Because everybody's politicized and everybody's on the take and whatever. But what's interesting is, you know, kind of the lead pastor who was, I guess, the opposition to us.
Okay.
We actually became friends afterwards.
Yes.
And we sat down together, had a very, very long conversation. I was at his place for, I think it might have been a Jordan Peterson event, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, really?
Okay. And I saw him there and introduced himself and knew some people that I knew and my family and stuff. And he realized I wasn't adversarial towards him. And I'm like, hey, you know, this is why we did what we did. And this is why we inserted, you know, that statement to affirm the rights of religious sensitives for you guys.
Yeah.
I explained everything to him. And he said to me, he said, you know, there was a time where Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell were strong enemies.
Yeah.
And they became close friends later in life.
Yeah.
They didn't agree with their worldviews entirely, but they learned to respect each other and understand each other's position and actually stick up for one another.
Sure.
And it said, so now you understand where I'm coming from. And you know, we become very good acquaintances ever since and friends.
Yes. Yep.
And, you know, it's anyways. Yeah.
Okay. So you get into politics, you kind of see the dark side of it. You see what it is. Did you keep pushing on anyhow or did, you know, is at that point you kind of transitioned to working, you know, being a trucker?
I kept on, you know, going along in politics. I figured I'll keep going until I hit a wall.
Sure.
Whatever. I treated it like a hobby sort of thing. And then I was asked by the conservatives to run federally in the election where Justin Trudeau was elected.
Oh, yes. That bastion of freedom. Yeah.
That's right. And so I ran in a riding that was unwinnable, but because I confused the people. Like, I live in basically communist Toronto. The Communist Party of Canada's head office is down the street. Like, that.
Yes.
It's all gender studies professors in my neighborhood.
You live there on purpose, right? You moved there purposely? That's your.
Because everybody leaves me alone. Nobody. I mean, the guys in the coffee shop like me, and everybody else doesn't want to talk to me. It's perfect. And, they were confused because, you know, they get this impression that all conservatives, all whatever, somebody that's not them, the other always thinks one way.
Yeah.
And I tried to, and I kind of showed that, no, there's a whole range of us on the side that have aligned values, but, you know, there's some nuance different, but we basically, you know, have a similar worldview. And we managed to go from, I think, 4% when I stepped into the riding up to just about 10%. So in politics, that's something that's quite significant.
Sure.
And then I decided, never running again.
Okay. So at this point, your brother comes to you, your racist cop brother comes to you and wants you to ride a truck, drive a truck with him.
Shortly after then, he actually told me he was getting a truck. He convinced me to get my license. I mean, he told me, "Why don't you get your trucker license?" I'm, what are you, crazy? He said it's a lot of fun. He did when he was younger. Again, I didn't know him.
Sure.
That's how he made his way through university and stuff.
Kind of way.
And I love cars. I, you know, did a lot of most of my private pilot's license. And I just like, so I'm like, yeah, okay, sure, I'll give it a shot.
So how long was this after you had first met him?
This was a few years after.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Okay.
Yes, I had already known him for a few years because I knew him just before I got into politics.
Gotcha.
Around the time where, you know, the 2012, 2015,
sure.
I guess.
Sure.
And anyway, so he suggested it to me, and I said, yeah, sure, okay, cool. I'll go get my license because the regulations were changing. It was very easy to get your license back then.
Sure.
So I figured, okay, what the hell? I'll give it a chance. And then, you know, I joined it. I ended up, part of learning, you get your license, but then you got to train at a company.
Sure.
And you train kind of locally and just by doing delivery. So I would go in like, I don't know, once a week, once every 2 weeks.
Sure.
Just to get practice. And then over time is when he convinced me to get a truck and go cross border. It was the COVID that really pushed that sort of thing.
Okay. So this is 2020-ish.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, okay. So you're working as a trucker
during that period. When I got rid of the business on the university campus,
yeah,
which we had a university location. We also had a vehicle wrapping location, Dodge South of the city. So I got out of that and I started doing podcasts. So when you get into politics, what's, The interesting part is you get to meet interesting people.
Sure. Yeah.
And I had met this guy. He was a retired intelligence analyst, and his area of expertise was your audience won't care, but
yeah,
was Islamic terrorism networks.
Nice.
That's what he was a court expert in the federal court and criminal court. It's different in the U.S. Like a court expert here actually gets grilled by a judge. So it's actually a real credentialed thing.
Wow. Okay.
And so I found it fascinating, and I said to him, I think I met him a couple of times. And one of the times I met with him, I said, hey, have you ever done a podcast? And he said, nope, I don't know. I have no idea how to do one, but that sounds cool. And I said, well, I could design a podcast around you. And he said, sure, let's give it a shot. And so we ended up doing it for 3.5 years.
No way.
And him and I met his collator, who's also retired. So an analyst usually works with a collator.
Okay.
Something I never knew.
Yeah.
And they gave me, I guess, over time, kind of a crash course in information source reliability, information credibility, which was his expertise.
Huh.
The process of doing analysis on a subject, disproving hypotheses, how it all works and stuff. And through those 3.5 years, I know the entire Muslim Brotherhood, Hezbollah, Jamaat-e-Islami, Hizb-ut-Tahrir network. Hizb-ut-Tahrir is not here very much, a little bit. But how it all operates, all the NGOs, all the proxy organizations, how the money flows. I don't
know. Wow. Hopefully.
And then we were, we did this for 3.5 years, and then boom. And I also produce a few other podcasts.
Sure.
I've mentioned before, Stephen Hicks, who wrote the book Explaining Postmodernism. So when Dan Peterson or Gad talk about postmodernism, they're referencing Stephen's work.
Wow.
I produced Stephen's podcast, Open College, which is
okay.
I learned so much about postmodernism.
Sure. Yep.
Over the time. So this whole experience of producing all these podcasts for people, like Diana Davison, a very well-known men's rights activist.
Yeah.
I produce a podcast for her and a lawyer who deal with false accusations and Me Too cases.
Wow.
So the additional benefit from producing these podcasts is if you get really into them, like if you're part of producing it, you learn how their industry and these people work because they'll teach you everything.
Yes, exactly.
So I was doing podcasting, a at the same time as getting my trucking license and learning how to drive a truck.
Okay. So I'm sorry, just to get some clarification. So on the timing of this, during what years were you actually doing the training, and then at what point did you actually get your certification and start going full-time with trucking?
The same year.
So okay.
2017, I believe.
Okay.
It's when I was training and starting new podcasts.
Okay.
And doing those things together.
Okay. So 2020 comes along here. End of 2019, 2020 comes along. You're doing trucking full-time. You and your brother is it pretty much tandem? I've got a buddy who drives truck as well. So you guys,
we try to go tandem. We can't always, because you know, sure, there's times where he does it in his off days.
So you guys, okay, gotcha.
Like I do it in my off time too.
Yeah,
but we try to go tandem.
Okay, so you guys start driving. You're crossing the border. COVID happens. What does COVID look like? How does it affect you? You know, how does it affect your work? How does it affect your life at that point?
Well, it was interesting, at least for me. Like, it didn't really affect my life at all, because I didn't care.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to the bureaucrats. You don't have domain over me. I think you do, but you don't. Yeah.
And did your foray into politics only reinforce your lack of confidence and lack of willingness to kind of, you know, abide by some of the things they were saying?
This is where I also learned about conspiracy theories are 99% nonsense. Because when you understand how incompetent, how grossly incompetent people are, they just can't. They cannot be. They're just, that's not the people who are in charge. We have a bunch of, I'd use some bad words in the description that references their incompetence.
Right? Yes. Yes.
So yeah, that really kind of informed me. And you know, I've told this story a couple of times. I remember, you know, there's a coffee shop I go to down the street on a semi-regular basis. Stuff. I'm in line. I don't have a mask, of course. Height of COVID. And some woman, and the guys know me there. The guy who owns it, Eduardo, wasn't born here either.
Okay.
So he knows, being Venezuelan, the government's out with crap anyways.
Yeah.
This woman comes up to me as I'm waiting for my coffee, and she said, and she's like, 5 foot nothing, with a mask, and she says to me, looks up at me, and she says, "You're not wearing a mask." And I was about to do, she said, no, I don't want to wear a mask either. And I said, "Then don't."
Let's go.
I said, the entire time, with the exception of, you know, when I went for surgery and stuff in a hospital.
Sure. Yeah.
I said, the entire time, I've not been wearing a mask. I forced them to ask me to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And every place I go in without a mask, when I'm sitting in line, I said, you know what happens? Everybody looks at me not wearing a mask. And after a minute and a half to 2 minutes, they all realize I'm not being harassed and I don't care.
Yeah.
You know what happens? They all start taking their meds.
Exactly.
I said, you just have to show a little bit of strength.
Yeah.
They will all buckle so easily.
Yes.
And
yes.
I said, and I need you to do it as well.
Yeah.
So she's like, oh, thank God. She takes it up very angry. Well, she's very sweet. She's very nice about it.
Yeah. Okay. So your day-to-day life doesn't change, but what does it look like to cross the border at this point? Like during COVID, was that affected?
No, it initially it wasn't. I had never been asked for any sort of COVID verification crossing into the United States.
Okay.
But what had changed, and this is what led up to the trucker convoy, is all of a sudden Prime Minister Blackface, Fidelito, Fidelito, which means Blackface, little thing.
Yeah. Yes, it's a... Oh, my gosh.
All of a sudden, they decided, oh, no, now truckers need to be screened, and they have to have proof of vaccine. And we'd been going for 2 years.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, and this was, you know, I said this in a few of the interviews. I said, we just want what England is doing, because England is relaxing their regulations now.
Yeah.
But this dumbass... he thinks he's going to increase regulations. Sorry, not happening.
Yeah.
And my big concern, being a techie guy, like I said, I've had a computer since I was a toddler.
Sure.
Was the data tracking app that I'm very concerned about. And that's what I discussed on Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
That, you know, what is that going to lead to, sort of?
Yes.
You
know? Yeah, we had, man, I could not believe. So we have some very dear friends who were with us in Uruguay when we lived and ministered in Uruguay for a while. And then they're Canadian. And so they went home. They were living in Panama and then went home for a while. Their kids were still up there, went home during COVID, and they weren't allowed to, like, they had to be, like, quarantined in their house for a certain period of time. Like, they couldn't even, they weren't allowed to spend time with their kids. Like, I mean, it just, I could not believe. And then they had, like, the cops tracking them to their house as well. They had to get the app, the whole deal. I just, again, it was so Orwellian and dystopian that whole time. It just was mind-blowing to me.
And it's so frustrating when you hear those examples from Latin America where, like, 80% of your population can't afford food, but you're wasting people's time with this horse manure, you know?
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah. Okay, so at what point does, you know, how, you feel this way, right? And, you're resisting in your own life, you know, and again, you're seeing the effect that some of your actions are having on, you know, anecdotally, some of the situations you're in. But, like, at what point does this kind of start to pick up speed and kind of develop into something bigger?
Well, it started, a lot of this I didn't know that was going on because it started, it really started in TikTok, if you can believe it or not, which, you know.
Can anything good come out of TikTok? Impressive. Wow. This is the first positive thing I've heard.
You know, and I have TikTok on a burner phone, and I'm always
like,
I got to get rid of this stuff. It's just brain poison for kids, I got to stop, you know, whatever. But anyways, it was on TikTok that a number of truckers started mobilizing and talking. You know, you might have heard the name Bridget Belton. I talk about her in my book.
Okay. Hey, yep, we will, you know.
And, you know, her and some other people, I think she was probably one of the first ones starting to reach out to people saying, we have to have a convoy, we have to protest and blah, blah, blah. And a bunch of, you know, truckers started connecting with each other online and, you know, building this idea of let's have a convoy, let's do something.
Wow.
That started, I believe, in November. And I got a call in the middle of January, I believe it was... starting to forget stuff now. I think it was January 15th, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And from Tamara, who I had known, who has been, a political activist much more than I realized for quite some time.
Okay.
And she said, you know, we're going to do, my friends and I started a convoy, which isn't exactly the entire story, but whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And she, well, I mean, it does now, but it didn't at the time. And she said, we started a convoy. Why don't you, I want somebody to help with messaging. And, she had mentioned, I love these truckers, but we need somebody who knows how to handle media and can avoid the traps.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, sure, I can do that and do some pressers. And, like, I'm completely on board because, you know, I just, the whole idea of the data tracking coming down the pipeline was really getting to me, sort of.
Yeah.
So I was on board from the very first phone call. And I said, great. So I said, listen, I'm just finishing editing a podcast, the one I told you about, the intelligence analyst. And let me finish this episode and I'll get working and putting together some sort of ideas, press releases, framing, how to reach out, you know, that sort of stuff. And that's how I got involved.
Okay. So how long between that and things absolutely blowing up and you guys becoming enemies of the state? And
Oh, very quickly. Very.
Oh my goodness! So in the beginning, obviously it's a handful of truckers, and then it kind of grows. How many did it swell to? Kind of at its peak.
The week of, and I said this in an interview, and people lost their minds. The week leading up to, like when everybody was driving, it wasn't one convoy; it's multiple convoys.
Okay.
Yes. One was 70 miles long. That was the longest.
No way.
And that was the Western one of the Western convoys, which had to divide up because, you know, the infrastructure of the highways couldn't handle so many trucks.
Oh my gosh.
And there were a couple of convoys from the Maritimes. Quebec got divided up into three different convoys, and it was just, it was all over the place, right? So, 100 trucks. I'm like, well, We had 36,000 registered when the server crashed. And when they managed to reboot, at least is what I was told, when they managed to reboot it, they got a whole tens of thousands more. They estimated around 50,000 trucks. And I put out a tweet that had that basically said we have estimated now, because our servers have crashed, 50,000 trucks and up to 500,000 people descending on Ottawa.
Oh, my.
Jordan Harrison grabbed that and retweeted it. And
said,
Justin Trudeau's going to have a very bad weekend. Well, and you know, I reached, look, because I know people in the podcast world.
Sure.
I know people in media. I've done stuff politically. So I had a little bit of a network of people that I could reach out to that I really don't ask for favors.
Sure.
But I tried to call in every favor I could that week saying, can you retweet? Can you repost? Do you want to have me on as a guest and whatever? And that was it. So I was doing everything I could to try to get as much attention as possible. And, you know, I always had this pet hate with the legacy media.
Yeah.
And I thought this can be the opportunity for alternative media to shine and to show the world we don't need legacy media. We don't need the scripted nonsense.
Sure.
And I kind of did some calculations, threw it in a spreadsheet. Okay, if I get this channel, I figured maybe I'm good for 100 million views.
Wow.
If we do right in the first week versus alternative media, which is not going to get any views, but just call
its name. Sure, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So what was the timeline between this getting started? It's days, is this weeks, is this, I mean, I'm trying to remember. Like I know at some point obviously it blew up, but
yeah, I was called on January 15th and I just dropped everything and just kind of hustled as much as I could in this. And we arrived in Ottawa January
28th. Okay.
So we're looking at just under two
weeks. Okay.
From when I get a phone call to when I arrive in Ottawa.
Okay. And so then how long did the protest last? Like, so January 28th, 3 weeks. Okay. Okay. So at what point does Jordan Peterson retweet? Is it kind of right there at the beginning, or did it take longer than that? Or?
Yeah, in the beginning when I started reaching out to everybody to try to get as much attention on it as possible.
Okay.
I think it was maybe 5 days after. I don't remember the exact date. It's all a blur.
Yeah. No, I totally understand. Okay, so at what point does the government intervene and start trying to shut down, you know, cut the life resources away from the movement here via the bank accounts and that kind of stuff?
Well, this is the part that in the fog of war, it was very difficult to see a lot of things.
Yeah.
Before the government tried to intervene, it was actually the political establishment, both the conservatives and liberals.
Yeah.
But the conservatives, the bigger problem.
Sure.
That tried to sell us out.
Yeah.
And tried to end the protest early.
Yeah.
Trudeau himself, he invoked the Emergency Act on Valentine's Day, on February 14th.
Yeah.
We went on for another, I don't know, 5 days or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But the provincial conservatives, this is why people don't like when I tell the truth.
Yeah.
The provincial conservatives invoked the provincial emergency
version of this. Okay.
2 days prior to Trudeau.
Wow.
And they sought an injunction to block all the money from Give, Send, Go.
Wow.
While the federal government was working to block GoFundMe.
Sure.
And this came out in the POEC testimony, and this is why they yell at me and they call me names when I talk about this.
Yeah.
That we see in the email communications that were submitted as evidence that Trudeau and the new leader of the Conservative Party, because Erin O'Toole had stepped down, which I think was part of the plan.
Yeah.
They were in email communications saying, we need to end the protest. We need to work together to end this. You know, we agree. We conservatives agree with you, Trudeau.
Yeah.
This needs to end. And so they wanted to do that while at the same time stand beside us and say, hey, we're with you, truckers, which is what they're still trying to do.
Yeah.
So I'm the one who says, whoa, not so fast. And that's why I get attacked online.
Yeah. Now you were telling me, so we met in Miami about 6 months ago, 7 months ago. You were unpacking this for me. So what, there was some point where some of the politicians said that they were going to come out and stand with you, and then they were going to, and then they ended up trying to stab you in the back at the same time. I'm trying to remember this. How did this go down?
Well, no, there were a couple of politicians. Like there was one politician who's now the leader, Pierre Poilievre.
Yes, yes.
he made a statement
okay.
to the CBC about, you know, why is it only one side of the political aisle can advocate for freedom.
Sure.
But that was a printed statement. You know how I know? Because they sent the Conservative Party tried calling me as early as January 25th and said, oh, we have a spokesperson for you. And we have some talking points for you.
Yeah.
You should say it's all about inflation. And yeah, because you guys are supporting the lockdowns and mandates. No.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know what I told them, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
You know, in a more colorful language. And so they were trying to get a hold of it and grab it from the very beginning. And I remember that first phone call. This guy calls me. He pretends to be a staffer. Turns out he was previously a premier. He's previously a governor. Our servant of governor.
Yeah.
Just a staffer. Yeah, okay, Russ. Now I don't. I didn't know. I didn't care. You know, politicians are like underwear. You take them off and put on. And so he was trying to get us. He was trying to get me to, you know, talk about inflation. I'm like, no. I said, listen, if you've noticed, while you guys lose every election because you haven't listened to me, I got the whole world talking about this. So I think I know what I'm doing. I think it's okay. we have a spokesperson. I'm like, oh, you have a spokesperson. Do you tell me? Please go on.
Do tell.
He says, yeah, she's really good. And she's got a lot of experience with public relations and stuff. And he said, the best part is she used to be part of the Liberal Party. And now she's on our side. She used to be part of Trudeau. So that will send a message. And I said, so you want me to go out to a bunch of Western truckers? Let's think truckers from the Midwest or Texas.
Yeah.
You want me to go talk to those truckers and tell them, listen, I got us a voice. It's a girl. She's not with that. And she was part of Trudeau. Just
nice. Like,
no wonder you guys can never. It's not just the left that doesn't understand human motivation.
Yes.
It's nobody in the political sphere understands human motivation. Like, well, you can't promise.
Okay. So they come to you, they start to cut off the funding. At what point, I mean, when that starts happening, who's the first people to realize this? How do you guys respond?
Well, there was some deception going on with cutting off the funding from the donations, and that was from our side. Diverge Media, if you haven't checked them out, go to divergemedia.ca. Independent media from Saskatchewan. Good Christian boy, very proud.
Hey,
of that.
Let's go.
But he cares about the truth. Doesn't care about party politics. Cares about the truth. As he said, that's the foundation of my faith. I'm not abandoning it. And I'm like, I get it. That's why we got along so well.
Yeah.
And he spent a year now delving into this, writing articles on. He's about to put together a 4-part podcast documentary series explaining all of this.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
But like, for example, one of the things that I didn't know that he uncovered was GoFundMe transferred $1.4 million to Tamara's bank account. It went to her personal bank account, and her bank called her and said, Tamara, you need to set up a nonprofit account. You can't put it into your personal account. We know what's going on. Great. Congratulations. But the money's got to be attributed to the right account.
Sure.
But while she was telling me and others, we have no money, we can't get any money, the bank called her. And you know how many times they called her? I don't know exactly how many times, but I know it was for 6 days she didn't return their phone call.
Wow.
So what's going on?
Yeah.
Now, Diverge Media has delved into this. There's a lot more to this.
Sure.
And that's why I invite people. If you want to know how the Freedom Convoy was truly subverted, keep an eye on Diverge Media and their upcoming documentary. That will lay out a lot of this stuff. So when we are in the moment, what we thought was that money was being blocked through injunction from the Conservatives, and from Trudeau on the federal level.
Gotcha.
And then it wasn't until the Emergency Act was invoked. We might as well just call it what you guys call it. You guys call it martial law.
Yeah.
First of the illegal
truck. Yeah.
Right? Not even illegally. The bylaw infractions. Oh, we need martial law for that. Send in the military. They even tried to get the military to come in. The military said, oh, sorry, we all got
COVID. We're good. Yeah, we're good. We have COVID.
They were calling trucking companies, tow truck.
They're calling
tow companies all over the eastern seaboard as far as Massachusetts to try to get trucks in to Ottawa to tow away all these big rigs. And every one of them said, sorry, we all got COVID. I can't go out because of COVID. So
that's all.
There was a lot of that going on. And in policing as well, there was a lot of that happening too, because most of them were on our side.
Sure.
Not the fact that the fringe establishment, that is our political structure, they want to think they were the ones in charge. They were not. And, you know, 90% of police officers supported us as well.
Yeah. You get, again, enforcement is a whole different thing than passing some, you know, people using that term lightly, but just basically just declaring that something's going to happen. You know, like that's right. Yeah, it's a far different cry from actually being able to enforce it. Okay. So you get to the point where the EMA was
invoked on Valentine's Day. Well, there's a good way to send your love.
Yes.
Wake accounts and invoke martial law. Is that the day they started freezing bank accounts? Mine was frozen, I found out, on the 18th. I guess there was a little bit of window because I heard chatter from people the day before me and 2 days before that they're getting bank accounts frozen.
Okay.
It was so funny. Somebody leaked to me the police report, like the intelligence report on us. And it was hysterical. I was like, podcast for this. This guy's a Yeah, that's right. You got us, right?
Yeah, meanwhile, like...
You got Al-Qaeda, you fucking
idiot. Yeah. My guy. No, you're good. Meanwhile, so you're sitting there having done the other podcast. You've got, like, you know all the in-depth things of Al-Qaeda finding and all these things. And then there's...
And then there's a police sergeant. And you were telling me everything that's still happening. Like, I know why the chief of police got fired, because I know the whole story behind it. Right? Like,
yes. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so where does... Yeah, go ahead.
So I tell the story in my book, but essentially it was on the 18th of February. That's when the police... Was it the 18th? I'm starting to forget the dates now.
Yeah.
Approximately that.
You're good.
But they started to move in, and that's when they started to do the arresting of people. And we were all told to leave, by our lawyers, to leave what was then called the Red Zone, because the government's moved in, set up police checkpoints all over downtown Ottawa.
Yeah.
As you know, like, it's like Tiananmen Square now or something. And I say that for the CCP.
Yeah. Hey. Yes, exactly. Hey, guys.
And I was called by one of the lawyers who I didn't, you know, I had an inkling, but I didn't know for certain. Like, I was warned about this lawyer and the other lawyers around them, but there's limited to what I could do.
Sure.
This was a lawyer working for basically the Conservative Party through a proxy, and told me to leave the downtown Ottawa area. And I'm like, I'm in the hotel. I got a broken ankle. I'm in a wheelchair. I don't think I'm a threat. Like, what do I got to leave? And, you know, everybody around me said, don't leave. Whatever you do, don't leave.
Yeah.
They're setting you up for something. I'm like, I know, but it's logical. I got to, you know, everybody else is leaving. So I'm going to be a team player and I'll get out of the Red Zone as well. We just wanted to de-escalate. The government spent 3 weeks escalating at every opportunity, because that's how incompetent they are.
Yeah.
Even at the point where they wanted to leave and it's time to de-escalate. So I'm like, okay, I'll get out of there. And I arrived at a friend's place just on the outskirts of downtown Ottawa, because I stayed there for another month and a half or something. And I said, you know, I appreciate you taking me in, because I was going to go there anyways. A few days later, I had to go to the hospital again.
Yeah.
And I said, why don't I do at least buy us, you know, lunch, dinner, something like that. I got to get on the phone, talk to the lawyers, figure out, but let me get some food for you to as a thank you and whatever. And then I tried to order Uber Eats and declined. Decline. What's a decline? I'm like,
oh no.
So I go to my computer, I log on to my corporate bank account, and all of a sudden, the section where it shows your transaction history, everything was gone. And it says, begin you this bank, your bank account, your transactions will appear here. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe they did this.
Oh, and then I went to
my other bank, which was Scotiabank, the one that was reported on in Zero Hedge after the government tried to blame the banks. I was waiting for that.
Yeah.
And that's when I released this email from the bank, basically saying the government forced them to do it.
Wow.
And that was the article in Zero Hedge. So that bank, I tried to log on, and my client ID didn't even work anymore. I couldn't even log on. Like, it's been wiped.
Completely wiped, yeah.
Yeah, but I was the only person there that knew and understood Bitcoin. And I had a lot of friction there from everybody.
Yeah,
even when I tried to explain to them that there's a good, solid group of people, and I tell people I am forever indebted to Caribou for what he sacrificed during this period and everybody who supported him and donated.
Yeah.
I was trying to explain to them that these people are raising money for us in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I got so much pushback. It's for criminal activity. That's a Bitcoin. Yeah. Criminal. What are you doing? Whatever. I'm like,
wait till you hear about the dollar.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And Gaddafi had tons of Bitcoin. He just had, oh, wait, no, it was all dollars. You're right.
And I went, it was funny. It was maybe a year ago now. It was many, many months after. If I remember correctly, is around the POEC time, but I could be wrong. I was in a Bitcoin space, and somebody introduced me, you know, oh yeah, he's the trucker convoy guy. And this guy says, I don't know his name, but he was using the handle Moses. He's like, hey, I was trying to help the trucker convoy. And I'm like, oh yeah, you guys did help and whatever. He's like, well, that's not what I was told. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, before you even got to January, and I didn't know this, he said, I got in touch with somebody named Tamara and some guy.
No way. Oh,
I'm like, oh, before? He's like, yeah, the week. All of us were trying to help out. Like, oh, okay, well, nobody told me this. Oh. And I said, what happened? He said, well, I got her on the phone, and I said, you know, we're Bitcoiners. We want to help. This is what Bitcoin is. It's censorship-resistant money. And her response was, I don't want video game money. I want real money.
Sweet.
I'm like, I can't believe, like, how duplicitous is this?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
When I brought up Bitcoin and explained to the board, or what our board, our informal board,
sure. Yeah.
That the volunteers, that there's guys on the ground raising Bitcoin for us, and they were standing right beside me. None of them said, oh, we spoke to them on our way to Ottawa.
Yeah.
Everybody was keeping everything quiet to themselves. That's how you know you're dealing with political operatives, because that's what political operatives do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So at this point, so let's see. So let's give some credit to some of these names. Who are some of the names who are involved in the Bitcoin side of things? The ones who I saw. Okay. So again, I know varying levels of involvement, but I know like Ben BTC Sessions, like he was one person who was involved. You had Greg Foss to some degree. I remember he was getting. I know those guys took heat. Who are some of the other people who were kind of on the ground trying to help with Bitcoin?
Are you trying to set me up as the one to sell people out?
are you not supposed to say anything? I don't know. Is this still ongoing?
Well, I mean, there's still the $450 million lawsuit. I don't think none of these people are a part of it. But
okay.
In general with Bitcoin people.
Yeah.
I mean, Caribou is a co-defendant with me.
Sure.
Caribou kind of knows.
Sure.
We're in this mess together.
Gotcha. Okay.
Everybody else who volunteered and gave their time and all that sort of stuff, I try to, you know, we know anonymity is why we love Bitcoin.
Sure. Yeah.
I try to do my best. If people want me to talk about them, I will.
Yeah.
But in general, I just try not to.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, no, I just am talking to the people who I saw talking about it and like raising awareness. I think the other one is, do you know Jesse Berger?
Why does that sound familiar?
I think so. He wrote a book. I think it's called Magic Internet Money. He's from Toronto as well. He's in there.
Yes.
Shout to Jesse. It's been a while since we talked about it. Yeah.
Yes.
But I just was floored. I just was floored by. I was again so excited that Bitcoin could play a role, and again you could have this use case for exactly the type of thing that was theoretical at that point, and then to have it, you know, borne out was just such a cool. Again, you would never wish this on your worst enemy, but to see it, you know, work out the way that it did. So this is just a nuts and bolts question. How did you guys what did you guys do as far as selling the Bitcoin to actually allow some of these truckers to, you know, to pay for their needs and stuff like that? How did that work?
Oh, it was distributed directly to them. So,
okay.
Caribou was, his story is a book in itself.
Yeah.
You know, he was doing all of this. His computer died. He had to run out in the middle of the night before the store closed to buy another computer.
Oh, my gosh.
And, that's the type of sacrifice he went and had to restart and rebuild everything from scratch.
Oh, my gosh.
He was getting, there's some people who are being quite aggressive online, and I guess understandably so, because they didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And Caribou said, hey, if you guys don't want to be so critical, can you just help me?
Yeah.
And to JW's credit, JW stepped up and said, all right, I'm going to help you out. Let's figure this out together.
Yeah.
And they did it. And this is where, you know, Sessions says, if this were to happen again, there's so many learning mistakes that were made.
Yes.
That they learned through this process that they would avoid in the future.
Sure, right? Sure.
But they managed to get $800,000+ at that time worth of Bitcoin of the $1.2 million that was donated, went directly to the truckers.
Wow.
You know, there's the famous video where the guy was streaming.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, but Caribou took a whole bunch of videos every time he did it. He did it, like 100 times or something like that.
Wow.
And I'd seen a bunch of them. And the only way the government got the remaining Bitcoin was they sent 15 officers to raid his apartment from the OPP and the RCMP.
Gotcha.
And they said, here's a warrant. Give us your computer and your seed phrase and stuff. And he's like, you know, you've never been in that position before.
Sure. Yeah.
Intimidating, intentionally. Yeah. They knew it to be intimidating.
Exactly, yeah.
And he acquiesced. He said, okay, here's all my stuff, and whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that's how they were able to get the remainder of the Bitcoin, which is in escrow right now, pending this Lawfare class action, a reverse class action lawsuit.
Wow. So as far as this lawsuit is concerned, explain, because I've heard a little bit about this, but I don't know a lot. So is this you guys suing them? Is this them suing you? What does this look like?
No. It's a group of small businesses that I suspect are proxies for the Liberal Party.
Really? Analyst. Okay.
Small businesses that have somehow come to the sum of $450 million in damages. Like, that bar must make a lot of money.
So you're saying they're suing you guys, saying that you guys did $400 million worth of damage to them via the
right.
Oh, got you. Okay.
Because, we'll litigate this in court, but I shouldn't talk much about it. But it's really frivolous. It's clearly just Lawfare tied to the political establishment.
Sure.
It's not yet been certified, but that is a process in itself. And it's a reverse class action, so they've named, last count, over 400 defendants.
Oh my gosh!
So it's a mess. I have a feeling, because it's political in nature, if the government, you know, was smart, they would realize, let's just move on from this.
Yeah.
And but you know, the problem with extremists like Trudeau. His extremists will always, and it Trudeau's brain, his name is Jerry, drunk lunatic, but the problem with extremists is they always double down on the same strategy, because they don't understand a worldview different from theirs, and they have the They think they're intellectual, but they have no ability to intellectualize an argument that opposes them.
Yeah.
And that's why they get themselves trapped.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I'm not envious of you there. Again, I am grateful that you guys were willing to stand up and not just continue to go along with this. I know there's there was a ton of support just vocally and obviously somewhat monetarily as well that was coming from the States. But yeah, I just think you guys, it was just such an important thing. I just started thinking how cool it was. We were in Uruguay as it was happening. I was telling people, I was like, I don't take pictures with people. Like I met a billionaire last week, like didn't ask him for a picture. But in Miami, I was like, I saw you. I was like, I have to get a picture with the trucker guy. I was like, I have to get a picture with BJ because again, this is so much bigger than, this is real life and death for lots of people, including in terms of the precedent that it sets. Both for people and them having a, some sort of something to gauge for future response. And then also on the governmental side of things, of governments seeing the cost of this kind of stuff and how it can go. And so, again, I'm really grateful for you, grateful for your time. And again, hopefully this won't be the last time. Hopefully we'll get you back on and you can kind of, get us up to date as to how this case goes.
Well, I just want to say another thing is, we had a great conversation when we met in Bitcoin Miami, and I really appreciate that. But I also appreciate, the kindness and support. People like yourself don't realize how much that impacts us, especially when, you get dragged through the meat grinder of the fake news media. You have all the bots online always. Scott Adams, somebody I've gotten to know a little bit.
Yeah.
He always talks about nothing you read about a public figure is remotely accurate. I know that because according to the fake news media, I'm both gay and married with children, and I'm neither. So
sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the fact that there are people like yourself and many others, especially in the Bitcoin space, that haven't bought into the nonsense and the political narratives and the two political sides and the billionaires who fund them, who smear the rest of us, and you guys just go forward with, no, we got to support people who stuck up for us.
Yeah.
That gives me a lot of hope for the future, and I really do. I can't thank you enough. I really do appreciate it.
No, man, happy to, again, have the small platform to, even have you on, just get to talk about these things and get your story out to even more people. So,
well, you know what you got to do then? You know what you got to do? You got to get people a Christmas gift.
Hey, there we go. Yeah, tell people where they can get your book.
It's simple. Go to honkingforfreedom.com. Honking for Freedom, the trucker convoy that gave us hope.
Hey.
I do like reading the endorsement because I'm quite proud of it. I read this I never thought I'd be in a day where I'd read this on a stage in El Salvador.
Hey.
The Canadian trucker protest in Ottawa attracted tremendous national and international attention and was simultaneously demonized by then Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his cronies in the legacy media, the minions at the CBC first and foremost among them. What really happened, Benjamin J. Dichter, integrally involved from the beginning, lets his readers in on the story, one that all Canadians should know, Jordan B. Peterson.
Oh,
and I'm always grateful for him for writing for that. So the spirit of the holidays, of coming together and valuing and loving your family and your friends and loved ones, this is all the positive story. So I don't get into the political nonsense of chatting who and whatever.
Sure.
If you want to share a positive story that embodies, at least for me, the spirit of the holidays, this is a good way to do it. And I know some liberals who've gotten this book who are now starting to get curious about it. And I know of two cases already where it's made people change their minds.
So, you said one of them, you said Trudeau was one of those two. That is so great. Fantastic. So here, we will give away a copy of your book when we post this podcast. So if you're listening to this right now, we'll do a few day delay so that people can listen to this and then go out there and like retweet, and then we'll give one away. So yeah, we'll buy it from you and then give it away. All right.
I'll, better yet, just give me the address and I'll support you. You get three books.
Oh,
why don't you give
wow.
three?
Okay.
Give me three addresses and I will send them to
perfect.
Want to send them.
So BJ, you know, government, Canadian government shill wants three addresses from some from some Bitcoiners. Here we go. Oh, I see the bastard plan.
It's Amazon. CIA.
That's right, probably. Yeah, probably. All right, BJ, really appreciate you, man. Hey, let us know, let our audience know where people can find you. You know, if people want to find out more about your story or follow you online, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I actually have a domain for all my stuff. So
okay.
BenjaminJDichter.com.
Okay.
That'll get you to the book, which is honkingforfreedom.com. There's a link to my Twitter, my locals, my live streaming, all that. I'm starting to do a little bit more of that stuff
cool.
too. Or if you want to get in touch with me, just go to BenjaminJDichter.com. That goes to my link tree, and all my stuff is there.
Awesome. All right. Appreciate you, man. We'll be in touch and talk soon.
All right, brother.